believe assault is an act, not an adjective. Your safety is not just on the gun, it is the gun. Freedom is a fundamental human right. Welcome to your show, Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes. Your safety is your responsibility, not the government's, not anybody else's. Be a citizen, not a subject. Better yet, be a listener. Because it's an inalienable right, not a privilege. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is live, right now. Call 1-800-313-9443.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the show. Yesterday, we did a bit of a piece talking about whether or not the Second Amendment was incorporated into the states. And I get home, and I check my email, and I get this great email from a fellow by the name of David Christensen. David has sent me a couple of different emails here and there. Here it is. Bill, I don't recall exactly the verbiage you covered in today's show, but I thought I would pass along something I thought I knew to be true, and with a little reading, am now without a doubt know to be true. I am 100% confident that the states have no avenue to deny our right guaranteed by the Second Amendment. Article 6, Paragraph 2 of the U.S. Constitution states, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding." So there it is. And he finishes with, "The way I see this, the states cannot pass any law abridging the right of the people to keep and bear arms, so help me God. Thanks for what you do, David Christensen." David, thanks for what you do. I appreciate that. I was actually thumbing through the Constitution of the state of Nevada yesterday, something I have never done before. Even though I swore to uphold the Constitution of the state of Nevada once upon a time when I was a Las Vegas Metro officer, I never really read it. So I was thumbing through it yesterday, and I came across this, Section 11, Right to Keep and Bear Arms, Civil Power Supreme. 1. Every citizen has the right to keep and bear arms for security and defense, for lawful hunting and recreational use, and for other lawful purposes. 2. The military shall be subordinate to the civil power. No standing army shall be maintained by the state in time of peace, and in time of war, no appropriation for a standing army shall be for longer of a time than 2 years. So, I gotta tell you, I'm digging that. We don't need to try to get an amendment to the Constitution going through to protect the rights of the citizens of Nevada to keep and bear arms, because we've got it. Again, every citizen has the right to keep and bear arms for security and defense, for lawful hunting and recreational use, and for other lawful purpose. Can't beat that. You really can't. So I'm happy to see that. If your state does not have something like that, and I would encourage all of my listeners to just go on and just Google, you know, whatever your state name is, Constitution, like New York Constitution, or you know, Florida Constitution, Florida State Constitution, something like that, and look and see what they've got. I would be very interested if you would go around looking to see what your state says about your right to keep and bear arms, and forward that to me, bill@2aradio.com. Forward that to me. I'd be interested to go through and look at all this. I don't really have the time and opportunity to research the other 49 states of the U.S. in any timely fashion, considering all the other things I'm responsible for doing. But if you're willing to do that, look at your own state and forward that to me. That'd be great, and we could have a bit of a comparison as to what the states say across the country. I think that'd be a pretty interesting comparison. And also let us know which states we need to try and go after to try and get it changed, updated, or added. More to come after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
Rule 1, assume it's loaded. Rule 2, don't point it at anything you're not willing to destroy. Rule 3, listen to the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. 1-800-313-9443.
In a further attempt to exercise the powers of the federal government from one branch to another branch, from one entity to yet another entity, the Department of Defense, of all groups, is putting out a proposal to where they would actually be in control of military actions, if need be, in each and every one of the states. And the governors are opposing this. Listen to this. A bipartisan pair of governors is opposing a new Department of Defense proposal to handle natural and terrorism-related disasters, contending that a murky chain of command could lead to more problems than solutions. Vermont Governor Jim Douglas, the chairman of the National Governors Association, and Vice Chairman Governor Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, penned a letter opposing the Pentagon proposal, which they said would hinder a state's efforts to respond to disaster. So again, these are the governors of Vermont and West Virginia. Current law gives governors control over National Guard forces in their states, as well as any Guard units and Defense Department personnel imported from other states. The letter comes as the Pentagon proposes a legislative fix that would give the Secretary of Defense the authority to assist in response to domestic disaster and, consequently, control over units stationed in affected states. We are concerned that the legislative proposal you discuss in your letter would invite confusion on critical command and control issues, complicate interagency planning, establish stovepiped responsible efforts, and interfere with the governor's constitutional responsibilities to ensure the safety and security of their citizens. Douglas and Manchin wrote that. That was what they wrote. To Paul Stockton, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense and America's Security Affairs. Continuing with what they said, one of the key lessons learned from the response to the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, and to Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in 2005 was the need for clear chains of command to avoid duplication of efforts and to ensure the most effective use of response resources, the governors wrote. Though the Pentagon has said the legislative fix would increase the number of Defense Department personnel available to respond to disasters, Douglas and Manchin expressed skepticism, arguing that the current law already allows the Pentagon to order personnel to key areas inside the U.S. A similar fix was removed from the Defense Department appropriations measure in conference committee for fiscal 2009, so it was just booted. Now they're trying for a new one. A Pentagon spokesman did not immediately return calls seeking comment. We've got now the Department of Defense looking to be able to exercise their, you know, we need little muscles when it comes to usurping authority from governors and state issues of emergency management. Again, be it domestic natural disasters or an act of terrorism. Now, I've got to concede, I don't know how many of these governors actually go through any sort of advisement on how to deal with something like this. Maybe they've got a little class that they sit around and do at the governor's ball when they all meet once a year. Or maybe they've got military advisors that talk with them about this when it comes to the state sort of FEMA organizations. I don't know. I'm sure that there's some sort of control in place. But for the Department of Defense to just want to go into a state and control this, or at least a portion of it, and screw the governors out of some of their control, obviously not a fan. Not a fan in the slightest. Not a fan at all of the federal government trying to exercise their powers over and above the states generally anyhow. That's why I was kind of, I expressed that I was in a bit of a pickle when it came to the whole reciprocity bill that failed in the Senate, which would force all the states that currently have concealed weapons permits, which would be 48 out of the 50, you know that by now, it would force them to recognize the concealed weapons permits of holders from all the other states, the other 47 states that offer it. Therefore, it would usurp 10th Amendment authority within the states. The only way that I thought that this would be proper is if the bill was written to recognize licenses, as it would be if you're if you have a driver's license or if you have a marriage license. But there's some licenses that are not recognized from state to state. You got to get special permissions. One of them that would be a medical license or a license to practice law. So not all licenses are recognized from state to state. Now, and I'm not exactly sure what to do about it. I'm not sure if each state should be able to allow for their own damn licenses in the way that they see fit, or if there should be a collective that gives everybody kind of the, I don't know, the right information. Like in some states, you got to turn off your high beams when you're within 200 feet of a passing car that's, you know, an oncoming car. Now, 200 feet at highway speeds is closed in a matter of about a second and a half, and that's a little too close for high beams. Other states, it's 500 feet, yet others are 1,000. So with all that being said, there's, you know, even though Texas will recognize a driver's license from Oregon, that doesn't mean the laws in each state are the same. But for general operation of a vehicle, things are pretty straightforward. It's just what the laws are, but the actual physical ability to operate a vehicle is what's being recognized. I wonder how that should be when it comes to things such as medical licenses for MDs or for chiropractors or for people that are allowed to do physical exams, nursing, certainly things like operating a crane or a forklift, carrying a concealed firearm. Of course, that's where we're really leading with this whole thing. The ability to practice law state to state. Now, I do know that one state is vastly different than the others when it comes to law. That's the state of Louisiana. I went to college in New Orleans for a spell, and the state laws within the state of Louisiana are based on the French form of government, which is quite a bit different than the other 49 states, which are based more on a Roman and British form of government. So if you go to law school in Louisiana, you can pretty well assure yourself that's probably going to be the only state that you ever practice in, unless you go to law school in yet another state, just to understand the way that the laws go in Louisiana. It's Louisiana's a lot different than the average state when it comes to this sort of thing. But again, it's all about this licensing thing. I would love to be able to pack in every state. Now imagine this. You live in Wisconsin or Illinois, one of the two states, those are the two states, that do not offer concealed weapons permits. But you want to travel, or you're going to travel, or you're forced to travel, and you want to be able to defend yourself. Would those states then be responsible for providing a concealed weapons permit for their residents, thus allowing the floodgates of everyone else to come in? Because the way that law was being pushed through was if you had a concealed weapons permit from your home state, you could then carry in all the other states. Okay, that's the way it was written, if you had one in your home state. So if I'm a resident of Nevada and I have a concealed weapons permit from Utah, that would not allow me to carry in Texas. I'd have to have one from Nevada. You understand? So that means that somebody from Illinois, which offers no concealed weapons permits, let's say they had a CCW from Florida, that doesn't mean under, if that law were passed, that doesn't mean that they could go to West Virginia or Delaware and carry, because you have to have one from your home state. Therefore, your rights to carry would be denied unless, under the provisions of that law had it passed, unless Wisconsin and Illinois provide for a concealed weapons permit, which they're not right now, but there's huge movements to do that. There's a huge open carry movement going on in Wisconsin. They do the thing in the park all the time. They do these picnics in parks. Matter of fact, there was one that just happened last weekend. Again, a big picnic in a park with a bunch of people going around, and they're armed. They've got their exposed loaded handguns on their hips, which is just fine. Now, in Illinois, there's no provision for any of that. But there's been, like the mayor of Peoria has been outspoken. Several different police chiefs and sheriffs have been outspoken. We need concealed weapons in Illinois. Allow this community in this area to be the test bed for the state. Let's give it a shot. So we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes. As a matter of fact, in New Hampshire, you can carry exposed and loaded. And there was a hubbub a couple of days ago because there was a guy standing there holding a sign. You know, the old expression that the nation, I think that the tree of liberty needs to be watered occasionally with the blood of patriots and tyrants. And he held a sign remarking something along that, like it's time to water some of it's time to water the trees of liberty. And he was standing along the route that de facto President Obama was using to head to a school to have kind of a town hall meeting of his own, standing in the parking lot of a church on private property, holding the sign with a handgun in a thigh rig. And a lot of people were just, you know, astounded by this. An MSNBC reporter was astounded by it. And of course, the anchorman looking at it was like, well, haven't they taken this guy down? Isn't that dangerous? And we said, well, you know, we talked to the police and the chief of police said there is no law being broken. He's within his rights. So did the motorcade go by this guy? As a matter of fact, they did. The guy was proving a point, and I got to, you know, hats off. Hats off. If that's legal, get it done. I know I'll do it if the guy comes to my town. I'll be out there exercising my legal rights with a loaded gun on me. Just to say, you know what? Second Amendment is mine. It's all about me in this case. More after the break. Stay tuned.
Have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. Right now, live, the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes.
There's a fella by the name of Ian Gorillo who writes for Time Magazine. He's an anti-gun scumbag. He put a piece in called Obama's Mexico Mission, Keep Guns in El Norte. And he uses a lot of false information and a lot of BS and, of course, a lot of anti-gun hype, the way that we expect these scumbag fools that actually in just absolutely void of any integrity whatsoever, void of absolutely all professional integrity, and most likely void of personal integrity. I wouldn't be surprised if these are the type of people that are, you know, regularly seen down on Crack Alley. But that's just my opinion here, my own thinking. This guy writes a piece talking about guns as a killing machine and also referring to these as cannon-like guns. And these are allegedly guns that you could buy in the States and transport across to Mexico is what he's alleging. And in fact, it's not. Just total BS. This guy, Gorillo, he uses his segue to talk about traffic of heavy weaponry as if his hand-picked anecdote represents a flow of guns that most Americans can't afford in the hands of cartel ground troops. Just really outlandish claims. Still, he unwittingly brings to use information by confirming what some of us have been saying all along. First, that Obama concedes that one major problem in stopping the traffic is the strength of U.S. gun laws and the gun lobby supporting them. And Mexican officials have pushed for the United States to reinstate the Clinton-era ban on assault rifles. Right? Now, that's what they claim. You and I know that that would do nothing to stop anything in Mexico. Because the vast majority of all the guns in the hands of the Mexican cartels came through importing from other countries through the shipping ports lining the east and west coasts of Mexico. And the people that run those ports being on the take, corruption, as well as all of the military guns, the M16s that they have, a huge majority of those came from the Mexican military, again, through corruption, or when the people there, when the Mexican army regulars would defect and take their guns and ammo with them. Obama said apologetically that it was beyond his power to overturn the assault weapons ban as we know here, as we know now here in Mexico, are helping to fuel extraordinary violence, he said. Having said that, none of us are under any illusion that reinstating the ban would be easy. This is the same guy that had a campaign promise. I don't want to take your handgun, your shotgun, your rifle. Right? Lies, lies, lies. That Obama can't do it yet doesn't mean that he won't eventually try to get around to it when trying to get the right opportunity to exploit any sort of news weakness or article that's coming out, especially with this whole Mexico thing. That's really what they're trying at. At which point I'm sure that Guerrillo, the guy who authored this Time magazine flop, will be glad to do his part to elicit response through the readers of Time magazine. And notice the way he goes from one class of firearm on the banned agenda to another without missing a beat. This guy's talking about, you know, heavy weaponry and cannon-like guns. Just all over the map on this deal. And when it's all said and done, Guerrillo's piece is not about keeping guns in El Norte. It's about keeping it out of the hands of we the people. Us here in the United States. That's what this Ian Guerrillo is talking about. He's talking about trying to take guns out of the hands of you and I. Is there gun violence in the United States? Absolutely. Without a doubt, there's gun violence within the United States of America. Is it out of control? I wouldn't quite say it's out of control, but it's certainly beyond acceptable levels. And why is that? Is it because of the people that can and do legitimately go into a gun store, buy a gun, go through the background check and all that good garbage, and then leave? Is it because of them? Or is it because of the criminal element on the streets? Well, now let's take a look at this. Let's say that we have 16 shootings in New York City in any one given day. Let's just take the number of 16. I don't believe that that's a stretch. If you take those 16, how many of those are going to be performed? They're going to be perpetrated by people who are not supposed to be carrying a gun. Probably 16, considering that there's a law banning the carrying of the guns there. And of those 16, how many of those would be prevented from going into a gun store and buying a gun legitimately and legally? The only way that they have an opportunity to do that is off the street and probably have what would be a stolen gun. Out of those 16, I would imagine probably pretty close to that 16, probably at least 15. So is the problem, and again, this is all theoretical, but I don't think it's far-fetched, is the problem the law-abiding citizen generally and in the vast percentage of things? The answer is no. It's the street thug, street criminal. Now, of those alleged 16 shootings, I should say theoretical 16 shootings, if the 16 victims were armed, how many of those 16 shootings would the guys have gotten away with? Well, probably more like 4. And you think that would dissuade the other dozen from shooting again tomorrow? It would. Definitely it would. Stay tuned through the break. More to come. I'm your host, Bill Carnes on 2A Radio.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Bill Carnes, 1-800-313-9443.
Okay. I stay on this whole thing about Obama and his health care plan because this would end up being to where the federal government, non-medical people, the federal government, has access to all of your medical records. And from there, they could start making determinations whether or not people with this certain affliction or that certain affliction should or should not be allowed to own guns. Let's say that it's hypertension, or you've got high blood pressure. they might just say, okay, you know what? Studies have shown, our studies, our limited studies, limited scopes, focus studies, have said that people with high blood pressure are more likely to go bonkers with a gun and start shooting people. So people with hypertension and high blood pressure, we're going to limit you to being able to own guns. You're not going to be allowed to own guns. Things like that. That's why I have a real problem with this. That along with bankrupting the country. I mean, we don't have the money to pay for this. And it's socialized medicine. They want to be able to pick and choose who can actually get medical care. Yeah. Not what I'm looking for. So the Obama healthcare plan is being helped by the drug industry. And this is a little piece written by a guy named David Espo from Associated Press. The nation's drug makers stand ready to spend $150 million to keep de facto President Barack Obama's overhaul healthcare this fall. According to numerous officials, a staggering sum of money that could dwarf attempts to derail his chief domestic priority, which would be, again, de facto President Obama's healthcare plan. The White House and allies in Congress are well aware of the effort by Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, otherwise known as PhRMA, a somewhat surprising political alliance which gives the industry's recent history of siding with Republicans and the Democrats' disdain for special interest. The campaign, now in its early stages, includes television advertisers under PhRMA's own name and commercials aired in conjunction with the liberal group Families USA. Numerous people with knowledge of PhRMA's plans say they've been told it would likely reach $150 million and perhaps as high as $200 million. They spoke on the condition of anonymity, saying they were not authorized to divulge details. Additionally, the industry is the major contributor to Healthy Economy Now, which recently completed a $12 million round of advertising nationally in several states. The ads were made by companies with close ties to Democrats and the White House and generally reflected the administration's changing rhetoric on healthcare. In an interview, Ken Johnson, Senior Vice President of PhRMA, said, "We will have a significant presence over the August recess, both on television and newspaper and on radio, but we have not finalized details for our fall campaign." I love it when people misspeak. Both television, newspaper, radio. Television, newspaper, that's three, but he says both. Both equals two. What an idiot. Ron Pollock, Executive Director of Families USA, said the partnership with the deep-pocketed drug industry is one of mutual self-interest. Even though the two groups disagree on numerous issues, we want to achieve coverage for everyone. Pardon me. For PhRMA, this would improve volume for prescription sales because everyone would have a better access to medicine, he says. So that's what it's all about. It's all about the money and their own pockets. Doesn't really have anything to do with what's good for America. Again, void of personal integrity. Absolutely void of it. Here is a piece I want to play for you. This is Representative Michelle Bachmann. And she's a Republican from Minnesota. She's speaking on the health care on the floor of the House just about 10 days ago. It's a really good piece. Listen to this.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We need to know what the people who advise the President of the United States think and believe about health care reform, Mr. Speaker. Listening to the President's advisor's actual words, I believe, is very enlightening. This morning, I read a column written by Betsy McCoy, and I'd like to quote from it extensively now. This is from a column dated July 24, 2009. Ms. McCoy wrote the following. She said the health bills that are coming out of Congress would put the decisions about our care in the hands of presidential appointees. Government will decide, not the people, not their doctors, what our plan will cover, how much leeway our doctor will have, and what senior citizens will finally get under Medicare. But what's even more important, Mr. Speaker, are the actual words of the President's advisors on health care. Here's the words from one of the President's first advisors, Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, the brother of the White House Chief of Staff. He's already been appointed to two key positions. One is Health Policy Advisor at the Office of Management and Budget. The other is as a member of the Federal Council on on comparative effectiveness research. This is what Mr. Manuel has written, and I quote, vague promises of savings from cutting waste, enhancing prevention and wellness, and instilling electronic medical records and improving quality are merely lipstick cost control, more for show and public relations than for true change. Isn't this what the Democrats have claimed we're going to find $500 billion in savings for? The president's own advisor says this is just lipstick. This is just a paper covering. This isn't where the real savings are. Savings, the president's advisor writes, will require changing how doctors think about their patients. Doctors take the Hippocratic Oath too seriously, he writes. Now hear me, Mr. Speaker. This is the president's advisor writing this. Doctors take the Hippocratic Oath too seriously as an imperative to do everything for the patient, regardless of the cost or effects on others. But that's what the people want their doctor to do. But Emmanuel wants doctors to look beyond the needs of their patient and consider social justice, such as whether the money would be better spent on someone else. This is a horrific notion to our nation's doctors, but it's a horrific notion to each American, because doctors believe, as Americans believe, that social justice is given out one patient at a time. But the president's advisor, Dr. Emmanuel, believes communitarianism should guide decisions on who gets care. He says medical care should be reserved for the non-disabled. So watch out if you're disabled. Care should be reserved for the non-disabled, not given to those who are, quote, irreversibly prevented from being or becoming participating citizens. An obvious example, he said, is not guaranteeing health services to patients with dementia. We just lost my father-in-law to dementia 2 months ago. I thank God that the doctors were able to alleviate my poor father-in-law's symptoms at the end of his life at age 85. Apparently, under the Democrats' health care plan, my father-in-law would not have received the high quality of care that he received in his last 2 months of life. Or if you're a grandmother with Parkinson's or a child with cerebral palsy, watch out. In fact, the president's advisor defends discrimination against older patients. He writes, and I quote, unlike allocation by sex or race, allocation by age is not invidious discrimination. Every person lives through different stages of life rather than being a single age. Even if a 25-year-old receives priority over 65-year-olds, everyone who is 65 now was previously 25. These bills that are being rushed through Congress right now, maybe even this week, are going to cut over $500 billion out of Medicare in the next 10 years, putting it on the backs of our state legislature to fill the gaps. Knowing how unpopular these cuts are, the president's budget director, Peter Orszag, has urged Congress to delete their own authority over Medicare to a new presidentially appointed bureaucracy that will not be accountable to the public. The president's next advisor, Dr. David Blumenthal, he recommends that we slow medical innovation in order to control health spending. You heard me right. He said let's slow medical innovation control health spending. He's long advocated government health spending controls, although he concedes they're associated with longer waits and reduced availability of new and expensive treatment and devices, but he calls it debatable whether the timely care Americans get is worth the cost. Mr. Speaker, Americans need to wake up and read what the president and his advisors are saying. It may scare them to go to the phones and call their members. And I yield back.
And because of this, what we have is we have people all over the country showing up to these town hall meetings and causing disruptions because they are so ticked off, just absolutely pissed at what this health care reform, this socialized medicine, is going to bring to the table and how it's going to burden the entire United States, many people, many individuals, into bankruptcy and tax us even more than we're already being taxed. Who's going to pay for this? Well, the stupid people say, well, the government's going to pay for it. Who pays for the government? Who pays for the government? They take our money, and on top of that, they borrow about the same amount. They have the Federal Reserve print about the same amount. It is so bad right now. We are so far in the hole. Do you realize, listeners, do you realize that every hour of every day, every week, every month of every year, the interest on the national debt currently is $75 million an hour? $75 million per hour. That's just the interest. Not the payment, just the interest on what we owe the feds. And who is the Federal Reserve? It's a privately held corporation that the corporate officers are a closely guarded secret. And the federal government allows this whole thing. Do we really want to trust this? The federal government is the least responsible organization in the history of modern mankind when it comes to financial responsibility. And we want to turn over the health care of 300 million people to this group? The federal government should have absolutely nothing to do with social related aspects of the lives of the United States citizens. Nothing. They should not be involved in what we eat. They should not be involved in what we drink. They should not be involved if you want to smoke or not smoke. I'm not a smoker. Can't stand smoking. But I don't believe it's up to the government to tell you that you can't do it. It should be your own damn common sense. I don't believe it's up to the federal government to assign us a doctor or to oversee medical procedures and to handle all of the financing of this. Anything and everything the federal government has ever had their hands in when it comes to anything financial whatsoever has been a huge, huge loss of money. An absolute financial failure. A total nightmare. And complete, just, again, failure of financial and fiscal responsibility. It's never done anything financially responsible with any sort of return. Now, in the Clinton administration, they said a couple times, hey, you know, we have a budget surplus. That's great. You didn't spend as much as you stole. That happened for 2 or 3 years. They didn't give us any tax breaks. No. They held on to the money. What did they do with it? Did they put any towards the national debt? No. I don't know that the national debt has ever actually been paid on. If anybody out there knows whether or not it's been paid on, call me or shoot me an email. If you want to call me, 800-313-9443, let me know if you have any information that the federal government has actually done anything fiscally responsible or paid on the national debt. Something tells me if you research that, you're going to come up empty. I may be wrong. I've been wrong before. I think I'm allowed to be wrong 3 times a year, and I think I've been wrong once. Was it once this year? I think. I got 2 more to go. And it's good because, you know, we're already in August. We've only got 4.5 months left. I don't see how anybody who's ever learned a damn bit of history knows anything at all about the history of the federal government and its fiscal irresponsibility could ever see that doing this health care thing would ever actually be good. And what it is, it's short-sightedness. It's people who are looking for their next meal, not looking to be able to feed themselves for a long time. It's like if you give a man a fish, he has a meal. If you teach a man to fish, he can provide for his own meals. Do you understand? If you give someone a handout, they'll take it until it's gone and they need the next handout. If you teach them how to earn what you're handing out, then they have the ability to do that. The handouts don't work. The handouts cost way too much because who's going to pay for it? the people that are going to be getting this socialized medical care, they're not going to be putting anything out of their pocket specifically, I mean directly towards this. It's going to be coming out of their pocket generally. And the people that are already on the handout process, that are already on welfare and such, what they're going to be doing is taking more and more and more. And who's going to fund that? The people who are actually working and contributing, paying taxes, doing whatever the hell it is that they do to get the funding for this. It's going to come from the people, only the people who pay in. But everybody's going to be able to take out. Do you get it? Do you get it to the people out there who don't understand, the people that are morons? Not everybody puts in, but everybody does take out. So does that mean that the people who are putting in more than what they're taking out? They're paying for everyone else? If 200 million people put in and 300 million people take out, that means the people that are putting in are paying an extra 50% than what they expect to take out into the system. Do you get it? Do you understand the math? And where are the feds going to get this money? They can't tax us into oblivion. I mean, that's going to cause riots and guns and shooting in the streets. That's not going to happen. So what are they going to do? They're going to go to the Federal Reserve and they're going to say, hey, print us more money. We're going to go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper in debt. We're never going to pay you back, but we're going to go deeper in debt. And we're going to use that as a scare tactic to try and get more taxes and keep people at bay and not grab their guns. Do you see this wicked web that's been woven? That's what we're dealing with. Stay tuned through the break. More when I return. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
Your right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back. 1-800-313-9443.
So what are we looking at here? What we're looking at is we're looking at the federal government trying to get their dirty little fingers into controlling every individual American, which is totally against the Founding Fathers' idea and the Constitution. This is the way it's supposed to work. You've got the individual. Then from the individual, you've got their family. You've got the neighborhood. You've got the community in which they live. Then you've got the state, which is really kind of its own little nation. Then you've got the states that interact through the federal government. But the federal government is trying to have direct control over each and every one of us, which is against all of the principles, all of the design, all of the initial creation of the United States of America. So for the federal government to want to gain this control, what do we have to do? We have to give it up. If we're allowed to go out and pick our health care providers, and now they're going to send it for us, we're giving up that right. We're giving up that power. We're giving up that authority. Once we give it up, can we get it back? Can you think of anything that we have ever had given up to the federal government that we've ever actually gotten back? I can't. I can't think of it. Reminder for all of you, Friday is going to be open forum day, so be sure to call in with your questions, your comments, you know, your topics, something that we would normally have or would be within the realm of 2A Radio. Friday's the day, 800-313-9443. Of course, you can always email me, bill@2aradio.com. So Friday, I want to have an interactive show. We don't get a whole bunch of callers on here, and sometimes we get callers and I'm not able to take them just because I have a huge agenda for the day. But the fact of the matter is I enjoy callers and I enjoy the participation. It always makes for good radio. And quite honestly, a lot of you have information on things that I don't keep up with. And it's really good to hear some of these things that I'm not able to keep up with. And this is as good a place as any to hear about it, such as the that whole training thing down in the Southeast United States where we had, this kind of an international flare, the Federal Emergency Training, blah, 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 whatever the hell it was called. If anybody has any updates on how that went with having some of these foreign entities in the country, and I was told there were no foreign troops. However, I was just at the airport in Las Vegas, McCarran International, about a week ago. I think Friday will be a week ago. And there was a lieutenant colonel from the Italian military that was there. And I don't know if he was here for some conference they're having in Las Vegas or was out here for the red flag exercises at Nellis Air Force Base, which I believe had concluded by then. Or maybe it had to do with this was one of his stops on his way home, because in fact there were foreign troops here. If you know about that, Friday's the day to call and let me know. All right? We gotta keep things in check. I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you. In Congress, the executive and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule. Thank you for tuning in today. I'll be here tomorrow.
Bill will be here tomorrow. Will your freedoms? The Two-Way Radio Show, 7 a.m. Pacific, 9 Central, Monday through Friday.